Welcome to Landlord Diaries, where we talk about midterm rentals and the opportunities behind them. We'll share landlord stories, talk about maximizing investment potential, and discuss how to live the very best landlord life. This podcast is proudly brought to you by Furnished Finder, the place for everything midterm rentals. Remember to like and subscribe if you enjoy our content.
Hey, 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 it's Kelly and KT, your host of the Landlord Diaries. What you think? You like it, Katie?
I like it. You know what? We probably need a theme song, and I think probably you doing some rapping would be the way for us to go.
Well, it's Kelly in the Austin, Texas area, Katie in the Denver area. We both love the midterm rental strategy and bringing guests from around the country to talk to you about it. So, Katie, who do we have with us today?
Today, we get to talk with David. David is in the Midwest in Indiana. He is like the perfect merger of all of our listeners and users for Furnished Finder. He is a nurse practitioner who is also a real estate investor. And he's taken such a creative approach. He buys properties that a lot of times other buyers might turn a cold shoulder to. And he's gotten very creative. He is also one of those people that has just like opened his heart and his brain to learning so much. And he's done so quickly and is now here to kind of share it with everyone. He's very sharp and it was so great to talk with him. I learned something. I think you learned something, Kelly. We get into details about banking and about carriage homes. I wanted to call them cottages, but they're called all sorts of things. Yep. So this is a great listen. Everybody enjoy. And please remember to give us a follow and a like and a subscribe and all those cool things.
Today, we talk with David Rosenbeck in Fort Wayne, Indiana, with 6 midterm rentals and 1 long-term rental. In 2020, David was a nurse practitioner making $120,000 annually, but wasn't seeing much of a difference in his bank account. So he Googled, what should I do with my money in my 20s? And landed on short-term rentals. But he found the midterm rental strategy was more his style. David will explain his unique buy box and how his misfit properties make the best midterm rentals. David, thanks for sharing your story today. How are you?
I'm doing great. Thank you guys for having me on. I'm excited to be here.
Yes, sir. We appreciate it. And I mean, knowing that you Googled, what should I do with my money in my 20s in 2020, and we're now in 2023, my first question has to be, how does your bank account look now?
Ooh, she's getting personal.
And how has midterm rentals affected your savings, your net worth, your financial leverage, et cetera?
Well, I mean, truly, if anybody that invests in real estate, they know that my bank account doesn't look that much different because any money that comes in, you spend it and you buy something else. So that it doesn't look that much different, but the asset side of my column looks a whole lot better than what it did before.
Awesome. Isn't that so funny? I was thinking that the other day, Kelly, because I was like, man, we have a decent amount of properties now. And I was like, still don't have any money because I've taken everything. As soon as I get profits in, I'm like, oh, there's the next one. There's the next one. There's the next one. But
absolutely. Yep.
So let's transition to that net worth side then. Do you know like what your average net worth is? I think you made around $100,000 in the first 18 months, right? Like where are you at right now?
Yeah. So my first 18 months of me investing, I was like, yeah, I did the Google. I was just like, what should I do with my money in my 20s? And so I actually found Graham Stephan first. He was on YouTube and he was talking about money. And then it ended up that he was a real estate investor. And so I started looking into real estate. Of course, I found Bigger Pockets. Once I found Bigger Pockets, went down that rabbit hole. I was, you know, driving 1 hour one way to get to my job as an NP at the hospital. And so I had lots of time to burn through a lot of podcasts. And then fast forward, I settled on the medium term strategy because once I got into the hospital, I realized that like everybody and their brother was a travel nurse in the hospital. It wasn't our old nurses anymore. I'm like, where are you guys staying? And they're like, oh, I'm at the extended stay Super 8 paying $80 a night. And I'm like, that seems insane. And so settled on medium term rentals and started investing. And within the first 18 months was able to generate over $100,000 in revenue. And now net worth sits somewhere around like $600,000.
That's awesome. Good for you, man. Especially so young. Like I wish I would have Googled that in my 20s.
I still feel like I'm old, because then I listen to some of these Bigger Pockets episodes. It's like, oh, 18 years old and has already flipped 50 houses and net worth of $10 million. And I'm just like, that seems insane.
It does. We each have our own different strategies, right? And there, I love that we can all be successful in our own ways, but it is easy to like see that shiny penny and think, ah, do I need that? But no, you find your strategy, you stick with it, and you let it grow, which is nice. We actually hear that a lot. Like we ask traveling nurses, hey, where are you staying? And they say hotels in the area. Do you still get that answer when you talk to traveling medical professionals, or are they more with it now and they combine in Furnish Finder or Airbnb into their answers?
So not so much the traveling nurses. Every travel nurse that I've had, they have gone straight to me via Furnish Finder or Airbnb. That's the main two places that I post my properties. But I had a couple other people. One of them was a guy that was like working for the train company that's here in town. And he was like, you know, transient working for the train company. He was going to be here for like 6 months. Or no, he had already been here for 6 months, and him and his wife and their dog were living in an extended stay hotel for 6 months. And I'm like, how did you do that for that long? I mean, I think I would lose my mind. And so we ended up renting to him now. And so he was one, and I think it's more the medical people, they're now in the know that like, oh, I just get on Furnish Finder. I'm able to find a property and it's, you know, furnished. It's verified. We know that it's going to be good. The price is right there. But I think for other type of, you know, people that need extended stays, it's not so prevalent. And that's what I think it's becoming more and more well known. But I think in the medical community, I think everybody knows now.
Yeah,
I would agree. Okay. When we were in between houses, we were looking for somewhere, and this was long before my Furnish Finder days. I had not heard of it. So we stayed with my in-laws, which we were thankful for, but we would have also liked our own little space. So
I tell a lot of people, like if you're fishing for insurance claims, that's kind of like the other big world. It's either traveling medical professionals or insurance claims. And I've only had a couple insurance claims. That's just not my world that I go into. But I posted one of my biggest properties that we'll get into later. It's my townhome. It's 3-bed, 2-bath, 2,200 square feet. And it was coming up that like it was going to have a long vacancy afterwards. I didn't have anybody booked and I started sweating just a little bit. And so I was like, all right, I'll just put it on Zillow as well, because I don't have anything on Zillow. And it's like within 24, maybe 48 hours, I had like three insurance companies reach out to me saying that they potentially had people that were staying. And I think it's because not many people know about Furnish Finder outside of the traveling professional world. And so anybody that's anybody, if you're going to look for a house, what's the first thing you do? You go on Zillow. And so then if you go on Zillow and you like click on the rent button instead of buying, everybody knows Zillow. And so I think that's kind of where you would drag in more of the insurance claims. I think a lot of people sleep on that.
Yeah, I think you're right. And I think it's important. Furnish Finder is growing so quickly. And one thing that's nice is that the barrier to entry is $100 a year, right? So get it on there. It doesn't mean you can't put it other places, right? Like spread it around kind of. It's just like when you're a kid selling Girl Scout cookies or something, you're not going to just knock on one person's door. You're going to go all over. But so yeah, I think that's a good point and a good reminder for everyone that like no one's going to hold you to just posting on one place. Just make sure you're managing all your systems well. So, all right, David, I want to hear about your buy box. And Kelly has mentioned something about misfit properties, and I'm kind of interested in what you have there and kind of also your story as to how you landed on the buy box that you have now.
Yeah, absolutely. So my very first medium term rental that my wife and I ever bought, I got tired of that like hour and 10 minute one way commute each day. And then especially whenever I was having a little bit of a transient schedule, I started doing some night shifts for our group as well. So then, you know, that's just not fun driving home at 7 a.m., you know, an hour and a half or hour and 10 minutes, whatever. And so we decided we're going to move to Fort Wayne, which is the market that I'm in. And so my wife started looking around, and I'd already been, you know, looking into real estate for probably about 4 or 5 months at the time. And her and I had been talking about it. And she sends me a Zillow listing and she says, would this work for that house hacking thing you were talking about? And I said, oh, for the love of God, honey, I love you so much. Yes, because it had a 600 square foot carriage house out back. And so in the Midwest, they call them carriage houses. You know, out West, they call them casitas or, you know, mother-in-laws, whatever. And so 600 square feet, it was fully renovated. It was ready to go. The main house was a 2-bed, 1-bath, 1,100 square feet that needed a little bit of work. And the property itself was $150,000. And since it wasn't technically technically a duplex or triplex or a small multifamily. It just had the carriage house out back. It counted as a single family home. So my wife and I were able to only put 5% down on $150,000 with a carriage house out back that was fully renovated. We moved into the main house and we fixed up the main house, but we got the carriage house on Furnish Finder as soon as we possibly could. And I think it was within 24 hours, we had somebody, and it wasn't even a traveling nurse. I was expecting traveling nurses. Within 24 hours, we had a 6-month booking for a lineman, like for the electric companies. Him and his wife were in town, 6-month booking. And as soon as that happened, we're like, oh, we're off to the races. We're never turning back.
Love it. And the misfit property side. So now you've gotten your first dip in the water, right, with this property back in the day, and then since then you've added seven to your portfolio now. So you have this theory about misfit properties. So give us the gold on the misfit property, so we can all be in the know around the nation.
Yeah, so I think misfit properties, I came up with the name just because they're the houses that nobody really wants. It's the 2-bed, 1-bath or the 1-bed, 1-bath, like 600 square foot, 800 square foot, weird, awkwardly small house that no investor wants to buy because it doesn't really cash flow very well as a long-term rental, and no family wants to buy because they're going to grow out of it shortly after. And so they usually have a little bit of difficulty moving these properties, the sellers, that is. And then they usually are selling at a very low price point. They usually sit on the market for a little while, so you can usually negotiate. The renovations on these properties is very cheap because you're only renovating 600, 700 square feet. And then whenever you get done and you have it furnished and ready to go, the utilities are extremely cheap. And so you're able to get, you know, your utilities are usually like only a couple hundred bucks a month to heat or cool and run the property. So I think that they're perfect because you can put a small yard out back. The size itself is perfect for any sort of traveling professional that's coming through, especially travel nurses, because it seems like every travel nurse has a doodle of some sort. And so you're able to have a fenced in backyard that they can let their dog out at. And just between how you can usually get them for cheap, you can rent them for higher than apartments, and they're easy to maintain and they're easy to find, and not many people are looking for them. I call them the misfits, but they're my misfits. I enjoy the properties because I think they work really well for medium terms.
I like how you mentioned the utilities too. I love that about smaller properties. We don't have any 1-bed, 1-bath single families yet, but we have a lot of studios. And I got a notification on my phone the other day. It was like, you know, an auto reminder that your auto payment's going through, because everything I have is on auto pay. And it's like, your $19.73 energy charge is going through. And I was like, oh man, that's so expensive. But it's just, it's, you know, there's certain benefits to those smaller properties that a lot of people don't talk about. And that is most definitely one, as well as the renovations. Now, tell us, have you guys done a lot of renovations on your properties, or are you buying them more when they're kind of ready to go?
Yeah, so I like to only have like maybe about 10,000 that I need to do in renovation, like, because my buy box is under $100,000. And usually that's, the Midwest is about the only place you're going to find that, which is where I'm at. And so try to find it under 1,000 square feet, under $100,000, and under $10,000 in renovation. And if you can do that with the way that the current interest rates are, your all-in per month cost is going to be somewhere around maybe $1,000. And you can almost always rent these properties out for pushing $2,000, if not a little bit over $2,000. And so I like to have my buy box be any property that I buy, I want it to make me at least $1,000 a month after all expenses paid.
Awesome. Love that. And I feel like you're a dual monitor guy. I just have this feeling, because you, if you're looking for misfit properties, I think I heard you have like one screen open for Zillow, another one for Furnish Finder. So how do you find these properties and know that they're a good fit?
Today's episode is proudly sponsored by Furnished Finder, the ultimate platform for hassle-free midterm rentals. Whether you're a seasoned landlord or just getting started, Furnished Finder is the place for you. With Furnished Finder, you can say goodbye to booking fees and hello to direct bookings for 30-day plus days. It's a win-win for everyone involved. So if you're ready to experience the joys of midterm renting and take a load off your landlord's shoulders, head over to furnishedfinder.com today. We make it easy to get started. We're grateful to Furnished Finder for sponsoring this episode, and we're sure you'll love what they have in store for you.
I always tell people, like, if they want an actionable step that they can take, the easiest thing you can do is pull up Zillow on one side, pull up Furnish Finder on the other, and then just take your categories for a house, and I want it to be two bedrooms or less, 1,000 square feet or less, make your price lower, and pull it up next to whatever the level one trauma center is or the biggest hospital is in your city. And if you have Zillow pulled up and then you have Furnish Finder pulled up next to it, you can look at the two of them and see, okay, these are what the Furnish Finder properties look like. These are what the properties are for sale. If I'm able to rent it for this amount on the Furnish Finder screen, if I can buy it for this amount on the Zillow screen, you can usually figure out within about 5 minutes whether or not you're going to be able to make money or not.
That's amazing. That's such good advice. We're going to have to put that one into a short, Katie.
Well, you know what, though? It's true. I think a lot of times people get stuck kind of trying to do a really lengthy analysis on every single property they see when really... Yes, you should do a big analysis on every property before you buy it or rent it or do whatever you're doing. But if you know the market and you have looked at Furnish Finder and you have you've really put yourself into the process, you should be able to tell by looking at a deal or property and then looking at Furnish Finder on the other tab and see what kind of those market rates are, what the competition looks like at a glance, right? If market rent for that type of property is only $1,000 and it's a $200,000 property, clearly that's not going to work out, right? But maybe you need a third tab with a mortgage calculator, but like that's really, then you can dive in and say, what are the utilities going to cost? Is there an HOA? What is my yard management going to be? All those types of expenses you might not think about, but you can do a lot of the work just by glancing and saying, okay, this property is going to cost me $1,000 and market demand, there's other people out there who are renting their property and charging $2,200, right? Like there's a good potential here. Then you dig in. So I think that's a really good point, because all too often I see people who are like, oh, I've run 100 different analyses. And I'm like, you don't need to run that many. Like get to know kind of the numbers in your head. And then you can really start to do like a little bit of a scroll and you can be like, ooh, that one might work, or ooh, that one might work. It's funny. We have a building in near the University of Iowa that we have arbitraged a studio in. I never even ran the full numbers because I was like, oh, that's rent. I know what this is going to run me. I know I can charge this. And then it worked. So we just did the same thing again. So we have three studios in that one building now because it's simple math, right? Don't overcomplicate it.
That's awesome. I think the next question is typically, how do I know where the level one hospitals are? Do you have any tips there? Because we get that question somewhat often.
Absolutely. So yeah, and people that are living in like really expensive markets, like, you know, Austin is becoming a very, very expensive market. And, you know, Denver's expensive and, you know, LA's of the world, stuff like that. And I have some students that are in like New Jersey and stuff like that. So I always tell people, like, at least within 2 hours of you, there is going to be a level one trauma center in a city that is at least 2 hours from you that you can drive to, you can set up, you can get it done. It's still in your backyard. It's far enough away that you have to build systems and processes to run it, because you're not going to run over there every single time something's going on. But it's close enough that you can easily set it up. And it's outside of that sphere of the really, really expensive markets like downtown Austin or downtown Denver. So if you just Google trauma centers near me and then zoom out on your Google map, you'll be able to see level one trauma centers around. And if anybody's not medical that's listening and doesn't know what a level one trauma center is, it's a hospital that has to be able to handle anything that walks through the door. That's how they hold their certification. So you have to have orthopedic surgeons in-house the entire time, not on call. You need to have plastic surgeons in-house, anesthesiologists in-house the entire time. So these people have to be in the building. So you think about how many staff members that takes, and they have to have a certain amount of ICU beds to be able to handle any sort of like a natural disaster or something that would be going on. So it takes a lot of staff to be able to run a level one trauma center. And so the my thought process is, with that much staff and with the way that nursing numbers are starting to decline, lots of people are retiring, then you can be safe to think that there's at least going to be some demand within that level one trauma center sphere.
Excellent. I love that. David's got some really cool details in regards to each strategy within his midterm rental portfolio. They're not all the same. So we're going to break each one down, some of them combined together, but into three parts: the property details, the purchase and the numbers, right? What are the MTR numbers? And then how is the midterm rental operations working at that property? So let's start with your two houses that both have carriage houses in the back. And I did some digging for those of you who are wondering, why did they name it a carriage house?
Well, I'm going to learn.
Back in the day, a carriage house was, or it was also called a coach house, was an outbuilding used for horse-drawn carriages and the tack related. I'm like, okay, that's pretty cool. So ADU, carriage house, we're going to jump in. Tell us about those two homes with carriage houses.
Yeah. So I like to say that I like puddle jumped my entire portfolio. And I suggest other people do this if they have the flexibility and if their spouse is on board, because that's also, you do a lot of moving. So it's a little bit of a pain in the butt. But our first property that we bought, it had the carriage house out back, and we lived in that property for 12 months. And then once our 12 months were up, for anybody that's not familiar with real estate investing, once your 12 months is done living at a primary residence, you can then purchase a new primary residence with traditional financing, and your old primary residence can become a rental. You don't need to refinance it. Literally nothing needs to change. The bank stays exactly the way it is. The bank's fine with it. And you can buy a new primary residence with a low down payment. And so after our first property that we bought that had the carriage house, we wanted to make the main house we were living into a medium-term rental as well. So we moved and we bought a townhome for 0% down, actually. And so this was in a USDA zone. So anybody that's not familiar with USDA, it's outside of city limits. And the reason they have this is just to promote people living a little bit more in rural areas and not piling on top of each other inside the more metropolitan areas. And so I had to put 3% down with the builder because this was a brand new build. I happened to see the properties being built. I called up the building company, talked to the owner of the company and said, hey, I want to buy one of these townhomes. And he said, okay, put 3% down. It'll be ready in like 4 months. I said, perfect. That'll work out great. And so at the closing table, since I was putting 0% down with my bank, they actually wrote me a check at the closing table to take home for like $4,000 because I had put down money. And so that was $230,000 for the brand new townhome. Homes, 3-bed, 2-bath, 2,400 square feet. And then the old medium term rental or the old house we were living in became a medium term. So we've got the carriage house that averages about $1,900 to $2,000 a month for medium term rent. Then now the main house on that property, which is a 2-bed, 1-bath, that averages about $2,100 to $2,200. So we've got a property that we bought for $150,000 that we only had to put down, I forget what the number was. It was like $7,000 or something down on this property because we put 5% down. That's now producing $4,000 a month in gross revenue. And we usually take home about $2,500 a month in cash flow off of it after all expenses for everything.
That's amazing. Love it. So that's the first one. And I think that specific property is one that you ended up deciding, you know, when you have a carriage house or an ADU, it's like, well, do we keep it as a shared yard or do we make it into a private yard as well? And I think you pulled the trigger on a costly fence to make it into a private space. Tell us about that.
Yeah. So I tell people, like, if you have any sort of interest in getting into real estate investing, specifically medium term rentals, the best way to do it is either house hacking by having a carriage house, like a house hack, if nobody's familiar, is being able to either buy like a duplex and run out one half of the duplex while you live in the other to help supplement your payments. Or if you have a carriage house or something similar, it's just something that is helping generate money so that it's bringing down your monthly payment. And so the carriage house that we had out back, I put a fence in between us and all the way around us because we have two golden retrievers and we were going to allow pets in the backyard. And we just didn't want to have any sort of, you know, interaction with the guests. So they're able to access the property from an alley behind it. And so we never saw guests coming or going. There was a fence in between us. So I called it a luxury house hack because you're not sharing any walls with anybody. You're not having to have any sort of direct interaction. They're not walking through your backyard to get to their property. And so if you're able to find these, it makes a huge, huge difference because it's basically like I was closer to the neighbors beside me than what I was to our carriage house out behind us.
That's awesome. And I mean, it's not an easy decision to pull the trigger on a fence because they are costly. So I think you went about it in a really cool way. Tell us about that.
Yeah, so I started shopping around of people that could like put in fences for us, and came across Lowe's, and Lowe's actually will come in and put in a fence for you. I didn't realize that. They will contract different fence companies through them to be able to put it up. And then I was talking to the rep at Lowe's, and he told me, hey, if you get a Lowe's credit card, it's 0% for 24 months if you use the Lowe's credit card. And so I paid for all of the fencing plus the labor, which was $8,700 on the Lowe's credit card at 0% interest. And I was able to pay it out over 24 months. So I didn't have to come up with $8,000 out of pocket to take care of it. So I like being scrappy.
Mm-hmm. For sure.
It's an important part, especially when you have some of those larger investments that come up.
Absolutely.
Yeah, for sure. And so I think now tell us about the second house hack with the ADU in the back.
Yeah. So my wife and I, we moved into the townhome. We lived there for about 3 or 4 months. And we kind of knew whenever we bought it that this area and this type of house wasn't going to like be our forever home, but it was just such a great deal with the 0% down. We're like, let's buy it. We can live in it for 12 months. We can move on to something next afterwards. And so 4 months into us living there, I got a new job working remotely. And so I was able to be location independent. And so my wife and I, we furnished the house with medium-term rentals in mind, specifically, you know, to rent it out to people that are coming to town to work. And then we took off and we traveled for like 8 months while we were waiting for our 12 months to come back up. And so we were actually renting out our primary residence as a medium-term rental. And a nurse anesthetist came in and she booked it for 14 months with her husband, who is a travel nurse, which was at $2,400 a month. So a brand new build, we were cash flowing like $700 or $800 a month on it, which I was thrilled about. And so once we got back from our traveling around out west and being in Denver and being in Austin, actually, both of your places, we came back to town and we were looking for a new place that we were going to, you know, call our home. And we're like, okay, my wife was like, okay, I think it's time that we actually buy something we're in for like maybe 3 to 5 years. And so we were really purposeful looking around, and in our neighborhood, it's in the 07 zip code, we call it. That was the area that we really, really liked. And we kept passing this other house that had a carriage house out back. And I was like, I'm going to call this guy. And so I cold called him, and it ended up that they were now living in Indianapolis and they were renting it out on Airbnb. And so I talked to him. It took like 3 months of like me just kind of pestering him, but in a nice way. Me and him had a great relationship until he finally was like, okay, I'll sell it. Cause it was their first home. It was very sentimental to them. But it had a one bed, one bath, 480 square foot carriage house out back. And so now the feather in my hat is that I have the only two houses with carriage houses in our zip code, which I'm thrilled about.
Hey, landlords, are you ready to level up your rental game and simplify your life? Well, get ready to meet your new best friend, KeyCheck. KeyCheck is your all-in-one solution for stress-free property management with tenant-paid screenings, rent payment processing, online lease creation with eSign, and a suite of incredible landlord tools. You'll wonder how you ever lived without it. No more chasing down checks or sifting through piles of applications. KeyCheck helps you organize and manage all things landlording in a simple and efficient way. So if you're tired of the rental chaos and crave seamless, efficient management, head over to KeyCheck.com and sign up today. Make landlord life a breeze with KeyCheck, the game changer for modern property owners.
All right, you got to tell us more about that. You somehow find this guy's phone number. A, how'd you find his phone number? And then B, I mean, I made plenty of awkward conversations in my day, but like, hello, sir. May I please buy your house? No. Okay. And then call again. Hey, are you sure? Like, you said you had a good relationship with this, but like, tell us, elaborate, please. Because absolutely. I mean, so many questions in my head.
Yeah. So the first call was made. We were actually in Asheville, North Carolina. We were still traveling and we had found this house. And so I did a little bit of, I tried my hand at wholesaling real estate. So I was at least privy to like how to look people up, how to find phone numbers, cold calling people, whatever. Didn't like wholesaling. Just wasn't my vibe. That's why I settled on medium terms. But I went through, if anybody actually wants to try and figure out how to find somebody who owns a house, you type in whatever your county is. So Allen County is the county that I'm in. Allen County tax assessors. And there are some states to where it's private information. They don't actually post it. But then a lot of the other ones, the tax information is public knowledge. And so I go on there and I type in the address for the property on the Allen County Tax Assessors website. And it pops up that it was the owner of the house. And then I go to the owner of the house. It has their name on it because it's on the tax records. And then you can go to truepeoplesearch.com, type in their name, type in Indiana or whatever state you're in, and it'll spit out any sort of records that have association with that person that this website can find. And so you're able to get phone numbers, emails, their current address. It's kind of shocking, honestly, if you go out to it. It's a free website. You can just type it in. And if you type in my name or anybody else's name, you'll find people, which is kind of wild.
I have needed that website. Thank you. I'm putting
you're
that
a little
my favorite.
Stalker, aren't you, Kelly?
And so then I just found him, and it ended up, the reason that we had a good rapport right from the get-go was because he actually went to the same church as us. There's a church in the neighborhood that you can walk to, and we just like kicked it off right then and there. But whenever I first tried to get a hold of him, because you don't know for sure whether this phone number is going to work. It just has multiple phone numbers that has been associated with this person. So I called, I left a voicemail, I sent a text, I sent an email, and then I also sent him a message on LinkedIn. And I think maybe on Facebook Messenger, I sent him a message. And I was just like shotgun spraying because me and my wife really wanted this house. And then finally, we were on a hike in Kentucky and he gave me a call back and I didn't have good enough reception to actually talk to him. So I called him back right afterwards. And then that's whenever the conversation started. And then, yeah, took like 3 months of grooming until finally he was like, okay, I cave. You can have the house. I'll sell it to you. Because he, like I said, he just had a lot of sentimental value to it because his wife and they started their family there and he just wanted to hold on to it. But he was like, you know what? It's going to a nice young family that wants to turn it into their home. I'm okay with it.
Did it show on that website what church he went to? Or y'all
no,
just
no,
figured
no, no.
that
we,
out
we
in
just
conversation?
Got, yeah, we just started talking and we just figured it
okay.
out. Yeah.
Okay, so then you moved to that house and rented the carriage house as well.
Correct. Yeah. So that carriage house was already furnished because they were already renting it out as an Airbnb. And so we were able to just tweak a couple of things inside there, put a little bit of like some of our stuff that we would normally put in there, like update some kitchen stuff. And I think within the first 7 days, we've got a girl that's in there right now, traveling nurse. She's here for 4 months. She's renting it out for $1,900 a month, off Furnish Finder. And our total mortgage for our property right now is like $2,343. And so we have a brand new house that we enjoy. It's much bigger than any house that we've ever lived in. And we're only paying like $350-$400 a month to live here.
Perfect. And so anytime we talk about carriage houses or ADUs, people want to know how does mail work? So how have you figured out to work the mail between
Kelly,
the two?
You, this is your favorite question.
It's actually
my favorite question, but if my favorite question is tell me your portfolio, your favorite question is mail.
It's I'm a show advocate. So what people ask me to talk about, I make sure and hone in on, and I talk about it a lot. And this is what someone wanted to hear about. So we're
absolutely
talking about it.
Yeah. So this property, the newest one that we have, the carriage house was actually the first house that was built on the property. And they built the bigger one like 20 years later. It was like this, the carriage house is like 110 years old. And so that actually has its own address. So that's a little bit different. It just all gets mailed to its own address because it's, you know, totally separate. Once again, there's a fence in the way. It's runs along the street. It's got an alley out back. So luxury house hack again. But our other one, it did not have its own mailing address because it was just directly behind the house. And so I started looking into this and you can actually have your mail delivered to the post office. I always tell my guests this, I say, if you don't want any packages to get swiped, if they're out front of our house, I'm not going to be liable for it. So if you want anything delivered, have it delivered to an Amazon locker. And I give them like 3 of the closest Amazon lockers that we have. It's super simple to do it. I've done it while we were traveling. And then with their mail, you can get a PO box for like $25 a month. And you can have all of your mail directed there if you need something mailed to you, or else you can have it mailed directly to whatever post office you're at and you can get whatever mail that you need. Or third option, which I was looking into pretty heavily whenever we were traveling, you can get a virtual mailbox. And so for like $12 a month, I think you can have all of your mail delivered to these big professional companies to where they will open up your mail for you. They will upload PDFs of all of your mail so that you can go inside your virtual mailbox and look at everything and hit the trash button and they shred everything for you, or you have all the things forwarded to somewhere else if you actually want it. So there's lots of options for mail.
There's a special name for that. I forget. I think it was D. Colson. episode maybe 42, she uses one of those systems for her business so mm-hmm. that everything for the business is funneled through that system, which is really cool. And same thing with the registered agent. That's what she called it.
Yeah.
It's like a business phone number, all that. So it's not tying to you personally.
Yeah. And if you do that as well, because I have all my properties in an LLC other than my private one that I own. And so if you have your LLC address, not as your home address, but you have it with like a registered agent somewhere or like a company that you can have a virtual office, your business line of credit, the credit card companies will be much more inclined to give you a much larger line of credit if it's because they view it as a more legitimate business. If it's not out of your own home, if it's actually at its own site, even if it's virtual.
Yeah, it's just you're taking one more step to be official. I'm at that point now where I'm like, okay, I'm ready to get my personal home address off of a lot of these documents. Just at a certain point, you got to do it. But
yeah, for sure. So we're on to the third and fourth home, which I think both are townhomes. So how are those doing and what's the setup?
Yeah. So the third one, then it turned into that was our old primary residence, the townhome. And so then that one turned into a medium term rental. Like I said, renting it out for like $2,400 a month. I think our mortgage is like $1,400 a month. And so between our expenses, usually about $700 to $800 a month in cash flow. And then I wanted to try my hand at an arbitrage because I'd never done one before. And so I just found my hospital was the biggest hospital that was in the city. And so I just found the closest department building to the biggest hospital in town. And I walked inside there with my scrubs and had my badge on. I think that helps a lot. And so I walked in there.
So you're saying I should go buy some scrubs.
Absolutely. And so I said, hey, I work at the hospital right over there that you can, you know, almost see from the apartment building. And I said, I own a corporate housing company. I specialize in providing, you know, quality housing to traveling professionals that are coming to town. Would I be able to rent one of your apartments with my corporate under my corporate name that I can then rent out to traveling professionals? This is not going to be an Airbnb that people are coming in and out of every 2 or 3 days. The other guests will not be disturbed by these guests at all because they're typically here for 3 to 6 months at a time. And I will personally vet all these people. And if you have any sort of additional documentation you require, let me know. And it's really hard for somebody to say no to that because it's like, oh, you're going to tell me that you don't want travel nurses or you don't want medical professionals to come into town, have a nice place to stay. And you typically do month to month leases with people anyways. And so it's not too far outside of their norm. It's much easier to pitch medium-term rentals than it is short-term rentals to a landlord or a property manager.
Yeah, for sure. Okay, so I think that is the first four. Correct me if I'm wrong. And then maybe five was in there too. And then your final one, and if I'm wrong, then just correct me and add it in afterwards. But we've got your student housing in your largest of all the homes. So tell us about that one.
Yeah. So then sprinkled in there as well, we did another misfit property. That one was $65,000, single family home, one bed, one bath. And we put like $10,000 into it. And the mortgage is $453 a month. And we rent it out for $2,000 a month. So it's absurd. And then we co-host a property for another investor. So that's another one of our doors that we have. And that was just, you know, happened to be another investor. He owns like, I think something about like $8 million worth of real estate in town. He's got like 60 properties. And I was talking to him about medium terms. He's actually a pharmacist. And I said, let me just take over one of yours and just show you how it works. And I take 20% of his gross income. So I typically get somewhere around $400 to $500 a month. And I don't have to own the property. I don't have to do anything. So that's another really good way for people to get into real estate investing. If you have zero money whatsoever, find somebody that maybe has some properties in town and ask them if you could try this strategy with them and partner with them. Tell them you want to partner with them to try and make them more money because they will make more money. And so, yeah, the college house then. I just listed the college house for sale today. And so it's, even though it is a, even though it's a cash cow, I bought it for $91,000 and it's a 5-bed, 2.5-bath house. It's one block away from one of the universities here in town. And I rented out, technically, it's one large lease, but the way I sold it to people was that you're renting it by the room. You're paying for your room. And so I told each one of the students whenever I was originally trying to have them come in that it's $400 for your room, flat rate, $50 for utilities flat rate. So $450 to stay there for a month, and all utilities are included except for internet, because I'm not dealing with internet if it's not working. So they thought it was a great deal. And I think it's a great deal because I'm bringing in $2,250 a month on a $91,000 house. And so my spread typically is around $1,300 to $1,400 a month. And I have my lawyer wrote up a lease that was specifically for college students that included a one-page document called a parent guarantor form. And so this one-page document, it says that each one of the parents that signed that document, I don't let the kids sign the lease until the parents sign this document. I kind of hold them hostage. And once all the parents sign it, they are individually and wholly responsible to uphold all portions of the lease. And so if the students want to rebel and not pay, or they trash the place, or they do this or do whatever, the parents are ultimately responsible for it. And so if the kid's not paying rent, you know the parent's going to pay rent, because that parent does not want to have an eviction on their record at 40 years old, 50 years old, whatever, and have their credit completely trashed because they're not paying $400 a month. So it really protects you as the landlord whenever you're going into a little bit more of a risky endeavor like student housing.
Yeah. So what led you to decide to sell it?
So I want to pursue other projects, and I don't have enough capital to do it. So really, I want to move more quickly. And so I think that I'll be able to sell it and net about $120,000 on it. And so if I'm netting $120,000 on it, it would take somewhere around like 9 years worth of cash flow for me to make that same amount that I can hopefully make 3 to 4 weeks from now whenever we close. And so it's just kind of the velocity of money. I know everybody says never sell anything, and this has been like a struggle for me so bad to not want to sell this property. But my wife is like, quit being dumb, just sell it. You're just holding on to it because everybody tells you you should hold on to it. Yeah. But I know that this is kind of the return on equity that a lot of people talk about. And so you need to look at how much is my property bringing in versus how much equity do I have in my property. And so people in more expensive markets really need to look at this metric. Because in Denver or in Austin, if you have a property that has $300,000 worth of equity, because through the last 3 years, the market's gone up by 30 or 40%, you need to look, oh, if I'm making $500 a month in cash flow off of it, but I have $300,000 in equity, how much could I sell that property for, take that equity, divvy it up amongst multiple properties, and each one of those properties is bringing in $500 to $1,000. And then I've got four or five properties that I'm having principal pay down, appreciation, tax benefits, and everything else with. So the return on equity is something that not many people talk about. It's usually the cash on cash return, but your cash on equity is really important as well.
You're right. Selling can be something a lot of people go, no. I know Kelly and I, we've mentioned our only long-term rental, that is our old house that we lived in. We've done much less moving because we have kids and a zoo with us. But we've rented, and we had it before the spike in equity we're very much in Metro Denver, but in Denver, and we have $300,000, I don't know, maybe give or take, sitting over there in equity, but it's a great cash flow every month. So every time we think about selling it, I'm like, oh, but it's like, this is like, that one is like as passive as real estate investing gets. I mean, I think I've had to do like three things in 2 years. It's very, but then I'm like, oh, but I could do so much with that money. So it is, I understand that the push and the pull from both situations. And then I'm like, I could furnish it and I could make more and I could do it as a midterm. But then it's a tricky kind of situation that you can work in your head. And it's a good problem to have because you're
absolutely.
Like, I could do this with it or I could do this with it. It's so many different things, but you're right. Sometimes, especially if you don't want to bring in a whole lot of other outside partners, you got to tap into some of that equity to keep the ball rolling. Right. So good for you for doing something and kind of making the decision and sticking with it. Cause I know it's been on my mind for a while and I'm like, I don't know what to do. We just signed a renewal. So I'm like, oh, I bought myself some time.
One of the main reasons also was it's probably one of my, one of the properties that I'm afraid a big capital expenditure is going to come up. I'm just thinking that at some point in the near future compared to all the rest of my properties. Because most of my properties, they, other than the townhome, that's the anomaly. They, most of them are at least 50 years old, if not pushing like 100 years old. That's just how properties are in Fort Wayne, Indiana, in the Midwest. There's a lot of old, old properties. And so this one, I have an inkling in the back of my mind that something maybe could go wrong with it as compared to my other ones. And it's also got the most potential for a really, really high selling point, because the way that I'm selling it right now, it meets the 1% rule. For people that aren't investors, the 1% rule is just kind of a quick rule of thumb. Whatever the property is selling for, let's say we're selling it for $200,000, it should rent for $2,000 a month. It's 1% rule. So that,
as a long-term rental.
Correct. Yeah. And so that's just a quick rule of thumb. So it meets the 1% rule. It's got that parent guarantor form in there. So it's a rock solid lease. The tenants have been amazing for me for the last 3 years. And so it's a property that I think will be a really nice for an out-of-state investor that has some capital that they want to use, but don't really know where to put it. And so I've already got the analysis. I've got 2 years worth of spreadsheets with expenses backing up everything that I'm saying. And so it should make it a really easy transition for somebody. And then that'll allow me to take that money and move forward with it.
So as everyone's been able to pay attention during this episode and see, you are really good with numbers. And that's always a huge bonus when you're a real estate investor. So part of being good with numbers is having your systems in place as well. So how are you tracking, you know, each house and the expenses and the, you know, electricity and all that kind of stuff? And how do you turn, how do you tie in your Furnish Finder account to your systems?
Yeah. So I just now finally did the right thing, and I moved everything to an online banking system called Relay. If no one's familiar with Relay, they should look into it. It's absolutely phenomenal. And if no one's heard of
it, it's great.
It's fantastic. And so if nobody has ever heard of the profit first model and they're looking to get into investing, if you can do these things at the beginning, instead of trying to do them once you have 5, 6, 7 properties like I did, it's a pain in the butt to go back through, especially if you're paying for all the utilities, like with medium-term rentals, short-term rentals, then you have to go through and transition all that stuff over. But now I have everything on Relay. Everything is on the profit first model, to where each property gets its own specific checking account. And so then whenever everything comes into that checking account, it all gets dispersed to my tax account, my profit account, my business expenses, my reserves account for in case things go bad. And then before that, I was just using an Excel spreadsheet. It's super simple to just make a simple spreadsheet. There's tons of people online that you can, you know, find a spreadsheet that somebody will have. And I would just, that was kind of like my Sunday ritual whenever at the end of the month, I would sit down, I would tally up all of the expenses for each one of the properties, put them into each one of their individual spreadsheets, and go from there. But as far as payment processing goes, I love KeyCheck. I advocate for KeyCheck all the time to people because I say it's so simple. It's a one-stop shop for everything you would need for medium-term rentals, and people trust it. And so, you know, if you use like Avail or something like that that people aren't as familiar with, it's a property management tool for long-term rentals. But if you're working with like travel nurses or somebody like that, they would say, oh, this is a sister company to Furnish Finder. Speaking of KeyCheck, oh, then I trust that. I'm fine with sending money through it, because there are unfortunately scammers out there that'll try and take money. Nurses know of other people that have gotten scammed. So if you're being a person that's coming forthright and saying, hey, I use KeyCheck for my payment processing, so there is a middleman between the two of us, you're not directly sending money to me. You're sending it through KeyCheck and then KeyCheck sending it to me. So they trust that more. It's a sister company to Furnish Finder. And so any of my off-platform bookings, like through Furnish Finder, they all go through KeyCheck. And then any of my Airbnb properties, you can set up different payouts with each one of your properties to go to separate checking accounts. So each one of my checking accounts, when I get a payout from Airbnb, goes to my specific checking account for that property within my Relay account. And it makes everything so simple to keep track of.
I also use Relay and I love it. And I'll tell you why I love it is because I also am an advocate for having one checking account for each property. I think it keeps your liability also limited, where if you were to ever have an issue, you can say, well, here's, you know, you're not putting all your eggs in one basket, accounting wise and liability wise, which I know some people will debate, but I just like to be on the safe side. But what I like about Relay is you can open like an ungodly amount of checking accounts online in like 2 seconds. I had some issues with Capital One and Chase prior to that. I was trying to use like, you know, we have a Capital One account for our personal use. I was like, I'll use Capital One. And they were like, you can only have 3 checking accounts. And I was like, well, ma'am, that's not going to work. Or I had another, I don't even remember the other one I tried to use where to open a new account or something, I had to go in person. And I was like, nope, also not going to work. Or someone else told me that they would only issue 1 physical debit card. And you don't think about these things. You don't think about all like, okay, well, yeah, I want a lot of different accounts, but I also want a debit card for each one, right?
Well, and that's the beautiful thing about Relay as well, is you can create the virtual debit cards instantly.
Right.
And so anytime I can create a checking account in 2 seconds and I can create a debit card in 2 seconds.
Yeah, it's
so
awesome.
Like, I tell people a lot, like, if you're going to do like an arbitrage or something pops up that you weren't expecting and like, oh, we're going to start furnishing this unit next week, you can create a new checking account, pull a couple $1,000 from your like business operating account, put it inside that account, create a new debit card for it. You can take that debit card, send it over to your iPhone so you can do Apple Pay or Google Pay, and you can go shopping with it and you have instant access to cash and you're ready to go. And so
it's awesome. And you can like label everything how you want it. It's very user-friendly and simplistic. And that's what I like about KeyCheck, is it's simplistic. I have a long history in the commercial real estate world where everything is very complicated because it has to be, right? You're dealing with a lot of large assets and a huge number of tenants and hundreds of investors, where it's like, you know, KeyCheck, Relay, these systems we're talking about, and Furnish Finder included, right? They're all very simplistic. We're keeping it simple on purpose because that just makes everything more manageable and it lets you put your time into your properties and your tenants and serving them and not trying to figure out another freaking software. So
absolutely. And that was another thing that drew me to Relay as well, is that you can have multiple businesses under one check, or like under one login. And so I've got my real estate holding business that is under my login, but then I can create another business. You put in your EIN number, your LLC, your articles of organization. And then like, well, I have a new business now that I'm running. It's called the MTR Masterclass, actually. And so it's to where I'm helping teach people how to do medium term rentals, and I'm doing some coaching. And so anybody that's wanting to learn about it, and mostly I'm focusing on like medical professionals, because I think that we work way too hard at the bedside and get our butts kicked, and then we don't think that we have any time to be able to do anything else. And I'm like, no, I'm a shining example. Like, you can do it all. You can actually get into these properties because they're so easy to manage. They're the sweet spot. I call them the Goldilocks investment, because they're right there in the middle. They're perfect for good cash flow, but not quite as good as short terms in some cases. But I kind of argue that in the Midwest, I get just as much for medium terms as if I would run it as a short term. And then you get better tenants, you'd get less turnover. They're perfect property. So, and they're super easy to manage. So that's where I like any medical professionals that are listening. If anybody's interested, my Instagram, you can hop over there and book a call with me and see if you be interested in maybe some coaching or anything like that. Like, I'm happy to help anybody or answer any questions.
Go ahead and give them your Instagram.
Okay. So my Instagram is just at David Rosenbeck, R-O-S-E-N-B-E-C-K. And no spaces, no dots, no anything. And you can see me posting a bunch of pictures of our golden retrievers and dumb stuff that's going on in the real estate world. So I usually like medium term rental investing is like a very smooth ship to sail. And it's been that way for like 2.5 years for me. But over the last like 48 hours, it was raining and pouring. And so I had one guest. I thought it was going to be my first episode of having a squatter.
Oh, and no.
So, so I hadn't heard anything from her. Airbnb. She was actually booked through Airbnb. And she was a traveling nurse. It was her and her husband and their 6-month-old child. They were staying at our arbitrage property. And I was like, you know, like, no problem. Trust them, not even thinking about it, because they're working at the hospital I used to work at, in the labor and delivery unit. And Airbnb says, hey, we haven't received payment from her. And have you heard anything? And I'm like, no, I haven't heard anything. And so then I reach out to her on Airbnb. She's radio silent for like 48 hours. No messages, no nothing.
That's a long time.
And so then, yeah. And so then I text her. I'm like, hey, I need to hear from you because Airbnb says they're going to cancel your booking. And she then, I think, took another 24 hours to finally text me back and say, hey, they're having some trouble with like processing my paycheck from the hospital. But she had said that she's been there for like 4 months or something at a different Airbnb, and she came to ours. So I was like, okay, it seems a little fishy. And then we were going, you know, kind of back and forth a little bit. And then radio silence for like another 24 hours. And Airbnb says, like, if we don't have payment by tomorrow, we're canceling her, whether you like it or not. And you're going to have to figure it out. And I was like, hey, so I just screenshot the email and I sent it to her. And I said, hey, like, this isn't me saying you're going to get kicked out. It's Airbnb saying that they're going to cancel your reservation. And she actually texted me back a really long message. She was like, I don't know what's going on with this. It's something with the hospital. And I think I'm inclined to believe her. But I said, is there anybody that has a PayPal account, a debit card, mm-hmm. or a credit card that you could just put in there for this month until your payment gets figured out? And then within like 2 hours, I had my payment and then all was good to go. So squatter avoided, but I was a little nervous there for a little bit.
You know what, we all hear the stories about how easy and how passive real estate investing is, but this isn't, it's not all rainbows and butterflies, right? There's times where you're like, oh, it's everything. Or there's times where you're like, how did this happen? How did this slip through the cracks? Or how did I get this situation? And it's going to happen. It happens in life. It happens in work. Mm-hmm. It happens in real estate investing, but it's your attitude towards it. It sounds like you had a very good attitude towards it. And we're very level headed, right? Because I think a lot of us, would have a little bit of a panic attack when we heard that. but it sounds like you handled it very professionally and very thoroughly.
Well, I always tell my wife anytime, because I get a little bit more, which is funny because I'm usually the chill one and she's the anxious one. But whenever stuff like this is going on, I'm the one that's freaking out and she's the one that's chill. It's funny. but she told me, she was like, you know, like, it's just like an issue that's going on. I'm like, yeah. And then every time that I'm having something that's going on, like an issue, I think about, okay, how much time have I actually spent on this? And I probably spent maybe 2 hours between texting and just kind of like checking into stuff and whatever, maybe 2 hours. And then she paid me and I make like $800, $900 a month off of that property. So her payment came through. I spent 2 hours. That was like $400 an hour for me to figure out that problem. Is that worth it? Hell yes, that's worth it.
Hey, well, we've had a lot of fun conversation today. You are so knowledgeable about just so many different aspects of real estate. I really like how you communicate. So I think we've given everyone plenty of information to think about. If you heard something, you're like, hey, I need that, then don't hesitate. Get out and make it happen. You know, I think especially like that Relay Financial, that's a great tool for those of you that don't have an awesome bank account out there. If you don't really know what your buy box is, well, David's given you some great things to think about how to create your buy box. So just whatever it was, don't let it pass you by. Take it and roll with it. So we're going to finish with a fun question, which we haven't talked about a ton on our show. And David, you really like in-person meetups or online meetups. So why is that? And how do you think that affects your real estate career?
It has sent my real estate investing to the stratosphere just by knowing people. And everybody always says your network is your net worth, you know, like whatever. And people are like, yeah, whatever. Everybody says that. But whenever my wife and I, whenever we took off and we started traveling, first stop that we made was in Denver, because I was like, I want to go to the Mecca. I want to go to Bigger Pockets headquarters and check it out. Awesome. And so
did you just walk in?
We drove by. I took pictures out front. We got to see it. I didn't walk in. I was a little nervous about that. I thought they were going to, like, you know, have security tackle me or something. but then the second night that we were in Denver, they had a Bigger Pockets meetup at a brewery that was right next by. And I was able to meet Scott Trench, the CEO of Bigger Pockets. I was able to meet Tony and Sarah Robinson. They were there. I was able to meet Mindy Jensen. I forget everybody, like basically the entire Bigger Pockets crew, other than at that time, it was still Brandon Turner and David Green. Neither one of them were there, but I was able to meet so many people. And then I still am in communication with those people. And, you know, like, those are some higher level people in the real estate investing world. And without that face-to-face communication or with a podcast, that's why I love podcasts, because you get to be friends with people that you normally wouldn't get a chance to hang out with. You get to build your network and you get to ask questions to people. But also, just here in my local area, we have a really robust Real Estate Investors Association. And so you can go there, hang out, ask questions, just hang out with other people, have a beer, and talk to people that are a little bit farther ahead than what you are. Find somebody that's like 2 years ahead of you, not 20 years ahead of you, because then that's overwhelming. Like, oh, I've got 50 properties and 20 million net worth. Like, okay, I don't really relate to you. But somebody that like me that, oh, you've got six properties and you're, you know, making like 15 grand a month. Yeah, that's great. I want to talk to you because I want to figure out how I can get out of my job like you did. And so going to these and asking questions to people, like, they're not nearly as scary as what people think. And if you can find somebody that like is really active, because all of these have Facebook groups. So find a Facebook group, go into Facebook, search Denver Real Estate Investor Association or Fort Wayne, Indiana Real Estate Investor Association or wherever. You'll find a Facebook group for it. Find somebody that is really chatty inside there. There's always about 10 of them that are commenting on everything, and just shoot them a message, start a dialogue. And then whenever you go to the RIA, we'll ask them if they're going to be there. Then you already have a person that's a familiar face that's there, and you can be like, hey, Jordan, how's it going? Like, I, you know, we just got done talking. So then you're not going in there completely alone. And so I'm a huge advocate for it. People should get out there, meet new people, because you are going to learn a ton, way more than what you ever will from reading or from listening to podcasts.
Yeah. And while you left the in-person nurse practitioner position, I think you're still doing nurse practitioning, correct? But online. Correct. Tell us about that.
Yeah, so I was fortunate enough. I took a pretty hefty pay cut, about 25% of a pay cut, to like the main goal for all of this. The reason I was wanting to do this was so that my wife and I could have more freedom. We wanted to have time freedom, and we wanted to have location freedom. And so with the my job, you know, as you know, healthcare in general, it's usually hands on. And so I had got wind of one of my old colleagues that she got a remote job as a nurse practitioner. I'm like, how did you do that? So I got a hold of her and I went through, and anybody that wants to look up remote jobs as a healthcare worker, I work for United Healthcare. I'm kind of open book. And so you can go to unitedhealthcare.com/careers. You can type in nurse practitioner, pharmacist, whatever, and click the little box that says remote jobs only, and it'll spit out whatever jobs they potentially have for you. And so if anybody wants to get a remote job, go for it, because it has been life-changing, because we're able to travel around as much as we want. I still have the safety of having a W-2, so I still get that, you know, bi-weekly paycheck. I get all the benefits, but I was okay with taking that hefty pay cut because I was having some money coming in from my real estate portfolio. So that's where a lot of people, I think, get hung up on financial freedom, and they want to have, you know, I want to be able to be financially independent, and I don't want to have a job. So let's say you're making $10,000 a month. How many properties are you going to have to buy to make up $10,000 a month in cash flow? It's usually a lot. And so for newbies, I find that they get so overwhelmed thinking, how in the heck am I going to buy that many properties to make up that much money? And then they just kind of like, you know, get analysis paralysis and sit there and do nothing. But what if you could replace 30% of your income? If you could replace 30%
of your
income?
What if you could just save enough to go on vacation every year? Or, yeah, pay, exactly. You know what I mean? Like, just start.
Yep. Because then, yeah, if you are able to replace a little bit of your income, then you can maybe take a job that has way more freedom, like what mine does. So I tell people, my job at the Cancer Institute, it was like a 9 out of 10 on the stress level, because I was dealing with really, really sick people every day. And then now this job is more like a 1 or a 2 out of 10. And so I was able to really maximize my my day-to-day life with just a little bit of income coming in from my portfolio. So I always tell people, it's not like a cold turkey thing. It's not, you have to have it all or nothing. You can kind of get somewhere in the middle, and that's a lot more digestible for newer investors.
Love it. Well, David, it has been a pleasure. Thank you so much. I can't wait for the next time, because you guys have heard, David has so much knowledge. We're most definitely going to have him on again. And maybe we can start picking your brain more about these older properties and why they don't intimidate Absolutely. You next time. So it's been so great. Thank you for being here. And everyone, please remember to do all of the things that help us to be a great podcast. Help us to subscribe, to comment, to give us your feedback. Please rate us and review us on Apple Podcasts and Spotify. I know it takes a couple minutes of your time, but it really does help us to get in front of more property owners and landlords just like yourselves. So we put so much heart and effort and time into this, and we would love just like 30 seconds of your time to help us out in the same way. So thank you, everybody, and we will see you again next Monday.
Bye, everybody. Thanks, David.
Thanks, everybody.